Welcome to Pull Up a Chair. I'm Bina Mehta, the chair of KPMG in the UK, and in each episode, I'm talking to some of the world's most influential leaders and thinkers about sustainable growth, what it means to them, and why it matters. We also explore the challenges and opportunities of delivering growth responsibly and ethically in a way that meets the needs of people, planet, and profit. Today, I'm joined by Paul Johnson, one of the UK's most respected economists and director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the UK's leading independent economic research institute. Paul is also a visiting professor at UCL and has a wealth of experience to draw upon, including hands-on experience of government, having worked as a senior civil servant in the Treasury, the Department for Education, and the Financial Services Authority. To top it all off, he is author of the Sunday Times bestseller, Follow the Money, How Much Does Britain Cost? We'll be discussing the responsibilities of business and government to unlock growth, but in a sustainable way. We will also explore what needs to be done on further and vocational education and what advice he would give to the Chancellor post the election. Paul Johnson, please pull up a chair. Paul, thank you very much for joining me today. You're not just a respected economist, you lead the Institute for Fiscal Studies and have been a very senior civil servant. So this conversation is going to be really interesting. So Paul, you're the director at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. I was wondering if for our audience that aren't familiar with the organisation, if you could just maybe share the work of the organisation and some context around that.
So we're an independent research institute. I mean, we are a charity, legally a charity. We are unidisciplinary in the sense we're all economists. The professional staff are all economists. And we work essentially on the economics of public policy, broadly defined. So we work on public finances, on inequality, the labour market, the tax system, welfare, health, education, a whole series of areas related to that. We're actually starting a big piece of work, one on the justice system, one on sort of ethnic and racial inequalities. And we do some work, a limited amount of work, in some middle-income countries as well, but we're mostly focused on the UK. We're essentially entirely funded by each year winning lots of research grants from research councils and charitable foundations. All of our work is based on analysis of very big data sets. Some people call us a think tank, and we do think, but we do all of our work is empirical. It's based on a really good statistical analysis of data. And we combine, I hope, the best of the academic world. So if we were a university economics department, we would be one of the best in the country, with public policy focused facing work. So I think almost uniquely, my colleagues publish stuff in the world's top economics journals and in the Daily Mail.
We are about to go into a budget. I'd love to get your thoughts on some of the options that the Chancellor might have.
Well, of course, it's going to be a very political budget, isn't it? It's probably the last one before an election, although the Chancellor is threatening that he's going to fit yet another fiscal event in before the end of the year. But he's talked a lot about tax cuts, so I'd be surprised if we don't get them. I'm not at all convinced there's space for tax cuts, I have to say, given the where the public finances are and given what the plans are for public spending. Nevertheless, I think the politics will push us in that direction. I don't know which ones we'll get. There's been obviously speculation about inheritance tax. I can't really see a strong case for cutting that, I have to say. It's only paid by the richest small group of the population. There's lots of cases for reforming it. I mean, it's easy to drive a coach and horses through it if you've got serious amounts of money, and we might want to try and close some of those loopholes and then maybe cut the rate a bit to even that out. I guess he's going to want more of a retail offer. We had a reasonably significant cut in national insurance contributions that came in January this year. It's not obvious that the government's got a great deal of political credit or benefit from that, so they'll be looking for, can they do something with income tax or some other tax which really resonates? My personal view is, if you're going to cut taxes, the one I would have top of my list would be stamp duty land tax, which is this tax on, you know, when you buy a property. It's a, you know, you should not have these transactions taxes. They really get in the way of things. But actually, I think the focus really ought to be on, let's make sure we've got the public finances in a little bit more of a steady state and have some money available after the election. It's worth remembering, I'm old enough to remember all the way back to 1992 when Norman Lamont was Chancellor. The budget before the election, he cut taxes and he had to increase them by more than that immediately after the election, because he knew when he was cutting them before the election that wasn't sustainable, and he had to put them back up quite significantly immediately after. I think that's probably what will happen this time around.
Now we've got the short-term predictions out of the way, Paul, can we move to what does sustainable growth mean to you?
We need growth, I think, is the first thing, and we need to get over the idea that some people have that growth isn't important. So that's the first thing, because if you don't have growth, then you don't have a happy population, you don't have people's incomes rising. To be sustainable, I think it needs to be reasonably shared. So it's not sustainable if it's only one group of people who are benefiting, or one area of the country that's benefiting. It needs to be long term. So often you hear politicians being chivied because growth hasn't happened this year, or they say they can get growth going immediately. This is a long-term project. I mean, if it's growth, for growth to be sustainable, it needs to be based on policies, on behaviour, which is aimed at the long term, at changes to whether it's competition law or the tax system or the planning system or infrastructure investment or whatever. All of that is something that happens over the long term. Of course, it also needs to be cognizant with issues around the environment and climate change, and actually we know that's possible. The UK economy is a lot bigger than it was 30 years ago, and our greenhouse gas emissions are much, much smaller than they were 30 years ago, and generally speaking the environment is better. So those things are consistent with one another, but you need to keep the policy going to make sure that we make the additional progress that we need. So I think for growth to be sustainable, it needs to be growth, that is the most important thing, actually. And I think people forget about growth too often and focus in some ways too much on the sustainable, but the sustainable is also incredibly important. But that's not just about the environment, that's about people, and it's about being focused on the long term.
It's really interesting, because I think you've already answered some of this already with the greenhouse gas comment that you just made. But do you think it is possible to deliver sustainable long-term growth that delivers to the agendas of planet, people, and profit?
Absolutely. And, there are so many examples of where you see that. I mean, as I've just said, that we know that rich countries, generally speaking, actually find ways of cleaning up their local environment, because that's valuable to people. There's no point being in a rich country if it's horrible and dirty and polluted. So people want that, and they get it. And we know that you can, through the way that we've invested in renewable energy and so on, and we're seeing a huge investment from the private sector in electric cars and all those sorts of things, we absolutely know that all of those things are possible. Doesn't mean they come naturally. It doesn't mean you'd have to work for them. And you need the policy framework and the long-term policy framework to make that happen. And also, of course, that framework and the expectations and people's beliefs and so on also impact the way that the private sector engages, and the private sector needs that sort of long-term sense that's where the world is going. That's partly where they're going to be forced to go, but partly where they're going to go because that's what consumers want.
And I know the core of this conversation will be around fiscal policy, amongst others, but how important do you think fiscal policy is to help enable long-term growth? And then we'll dig a little bit about the sorts of things that you think might be helpful.
Well, there's all sorts of details of fiscal policy that are obviously important. So you need a sensible tax system. That doesn't necessarily mean a low tax system, but it doesn't mean a well-designed tax system. And we can see that countries with very different levels of tax in total can grow well, but we also know that if you're disincentivizing investment or house moves or whatever with the structure of the tax system, then that is a barrier to growth. So you need to get the tax system right. Probably even more importantly is how you spend the money. It's pretty clear in a sense that the UK has underinvested, for example, in infrastructure over a period of time. We've underinvested in some aspects of education. It also matters how you design your health system and your welfare system. So all of those things matter for growth. And of course, there are a whole lot of things that are nothing to do with fiscal policy, whether that's planning policy or industrial policy or competition policy or what have you. But you need all of those things together to get growth going. But certainly fiscal is part of the story.
We're going to talk about the economy here shortly, but how much do you think the geopolitical instability that we're experiencing at the moment is going to impact our economy as you sort of look forward longer term as opposed to just immediate term?
Well, I mean, instability generally is a problem for investment. We know that. We've had more crises in recent years than we've been used to, and that's they can have long term sort of negative consequences, partly because of their fiscal consequences actually, and that's one of the things that we're facing at the moment. If you have instability, whether it's the energy price spikes or COVID or whatever, that can create lots more borrowing, lots more interest payments, and therefore problems on the fiscal side. Clearly, an important part of the instability that we're seeing is potential trade wars issues between China and the US or UK trade agreements or what have you. I think we'll probably come on to talk about trade later, but trade really matters. I mean, we know it matters enormously, both in the short run in terms of the supply chains and price spikes and so on, but absolutely in the long run, because if you don't have effective trade, then you're going to hold growth down.
So, Paul, you're a best-selling author and your book's called Follow the Money. And in your book, you talk about that we can't have American levels of tax and European levels of public spending. Could you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean the statement that you can't have American levels of tax and European levels of spending at one level is obvious, but in a sense we all want it. We all want low levels of tax and great public services, but we can't have it, and it's one of the great problems of politics. And I think it's a particular problem in the UK that it's very hard for politicians to talk about the trade-offs here. I mean, at this particular moment, the government is talking about cutting taxes in the run-up to an election, at the same time that their own numbers imply some pretty harsh spending squeezes afterwards. Well, that's a plausible. I mean, we might decide that we want low levels of taxes and a much less effective public realm. That is a reasonable choice to make, but we need to be clear that that's the choice we're making. I think much more likely, and what we've seen actually over the last few years, is that you can cut spending to a degree, and then what we've seen since about 2015, 2016, is that government has kept saying it's going to cut spending and not managed to do it, and it's sort of lived in a slightly false world in which the claim is always, next time round, we'll keep spending under control. Haven't managed to do it. Had to raise taxes quickly and actually continually bailing out public services. We've seen a big bailout of local government because lots of local authorities have been going bust. Each year, the NHS gets a bit of a bailout at the end of the year. Each spending review, government finds tens of billions more than it said it was going to find. And even with all of that, we're still in a world where we've got record waiting lists for the NHS. We've got prisons that are overflowing, a justice system with huge backlogs, local authorities going bust, social care system breaking down, and so on and so on.
Do you think our voters really understand these trade-offs that you've just talked about?
I think there's a sort of, there's almost a conspiracy of not wanting to talk about these trade-offs, really. We can blame the politicians, but actually we, the voters, are also partly to blame because we don't like to be told about those trade-offs. It's very nice to be told you can have your cake and
Absolutely.
Eat it, isn't it? We would all love to have our cake and eat it. But I think one of the ways that people get round it is to say, yes, of course I want more spending. Yes, of course there should be more tax, but someone else can pay the tax. And that someone else is usually, quotes, the rich or, quotes, multinational companies. And of course, I mean, there is probably more scope to tax some aspects of wealth, probably, but not in a way that's going to make dramatic differences to the amount of money that's coming in. It's worth saying this government, actually since 2010, has really significantly, and this is not something I think is generally understood, made the income tax system much more progressive. People on high incomes are actually paying a lot more tax than they were. Of course, the rate of corporation tax has been increased, and corporation tax is at its highest, pretty close to its highest level ever as a fraction of national income in the UK. And the other thing it's worth saying is, if you look at Western European countries which have higher tax burdens than we do, pretty much all of them get that by having, I'm afraid, higher taxes on people on average kinds of incomes. They're not getting much more from companies and the super rich. So the trade-off is a real one between, you know, real people having to pay more tax, not just the super rich having to pay more tax in order to get those better public services.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of articulating it, because you talked about, you know, you need sensible, well-defined systems, but you need to make sensible choices too. And I think as voters too, we have a responsibility in that, and to lean into that as well. I'd love to get your views if any country that, you know, you look and say they're getting that balance right at the moment, or have got the balance right.
Well, I don't think anyone's, you know, people have different balances. It is remarkable in some of the Scandinavian countries, the sort of the acceptance in Denmark, for example, of very high levels of tax. But you can also, but that's partly because they can see the very good levels of public provision that buys. And I think one of the problems we face at the moment in the UK is that our taxes are actually higher than they've ever been. But we're not buying great public services with them, and partly because we're spending an awful lot on debt interest. And you can see in somewhere like France, which also has remarkably high levels of tax, you know, some of that doesn't work terribly well. I mean, there are a group of, you know, people who do very well, very, very well out of that, and pensioners particularly do extremely well out of it. But there are a group that are left behind as well. So you can get high levels of tax which create problems in themselves.
To drive sustainable growth and productivity, good trading relationships are important because they drive investment in people, technology, and bring capital. You know, we know that businesses that attract investment, those that trade overseas, are typically more productive. To support that level of investment, to help these businesses, we need to really be really clear about how we make the UK an attractive place to either invest or do business with. I'd like to get your thoughts on what policies might help or signal to the rest of the world that we are open to business.
I first just to agree very strongly with what you say. The evidence is unbelievably clear that foreign direct investment, trade, openness are just incredibly good for growth, particularly actually foreign direct investment. And one of the things that we know since 2016 is that investment in the UK has really struggled. Second thing I'd say is, to show we're open for business, we do need a degree of political stability. And we've lacked that since, to some extent I think it's returning. I mean, we can all look at the politics at the moment and think, oh my goodness, but it's much more normal. It's a more normal sort of, you know, annoying politics at the moment than we've had, say, between 2016 and 2022. And I'm hopeful, actually, they often say that, I'm sort of somewhat optimistic that we are moving to a sort of, a post-Brexit world of something rather more stable. And I'm not blaming Brexit for the instability from 2016, let me be clear, but it was absolutely clear that the politics were unstable. And I think that would have been true whichever way the vote had gone, 52-48, either way. I think we'd have had a great deal of instability. And you talk to government ministers today or at the time, and they'll tell you they didn't have any chance to focus on anything other than the politics. And investors looked and thought, well, is this really a stable country? So that's necessary, but of course it's not sufficient for showing the world that we're open and so on. I mean, part of that is, you know, a lot of what London has actually, which is, you know, effective, productive clusters, highly educated population, an environment which is attractive, but actually some parts of the country either don't have it, and particularly don't have those clusters or that inward magnetic pull that particularly London and, you know, one or two other places do have. And it's one of these things that does, you know, it pulls on itself to some extent. Once you show that it's effective in a place, then you attract and you attract more.
Yeah, and I think the nature of trade is evolving as well. You know, so services is a much larger proportion of trade than it was historically. And also digitalization and digital services. As you said, you know, the UK itself has such a great reputation for innovation and technology. We've got the academia here. So that is going to be growing. And that presents slightly different challenges. And that's why, you know, how do you, what could government do or what does business need to do to really showcase the great opportunity, one, to export, but more importantly, to attract investment.
Yeah, and I mean, partly it is that, you know, as you say, very effective university sector, which is beginning to, you know, beginning to make quite a lot of complaints at the moment, and you know, that may indicate some problems coming down the road. We know that services exports actually done really quite well recently. I think there remain some risks as we. If we diverge further from Europe, as new companies try to enter this, and it's more complex than it used to be to trade in those services, so there are some risks. But again, you know, we've got so much to build on, the technology clusters, the professional services clusters, and so on. And we, I don't quite know what it is for, you know, for government to do to, you know, I don't think it has much effect if Rishi Sunak goes out there and tells the world, hey, guys, brilliant, Britain's brilliant. And I don't think it probably makes that much difference whether, you know, he moves the corporation tax rate up or down a bit. But I do think it makes a difference as we sort of reassert our reputation for stability and competence. And it's clear to people we have a well-educated workforce, infrastructure that works, competition regime that's not overly intrusive but is effective, and regulation which is, again, effective but not excessively intrusive. I mean, these are all sort of obvious points. They're sort of truisms, but yeah. I think they're no less valuable for that because they are truisms that are often ignored.
I think you're absolutely right. They're all the ingredients, you know, the stability, the certainty, the openness, the welcomeness. All of these things make an environment that helps businesses succeed, but sometimes you don't have all of those ingredients. And I think just getting that mix right now for us is really important, especially for the smaller companies who want to grow, and they are the engine.
They're also the ones that have stopped trading in the single market. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing the statistics on this, which show actually trade with Europe has not changed that much in total, but the composition has changed astoundingly in the sense that there's so much less being done by smaller firms because the costs are so much bigger. If you're a big firm, then you can bear those costs. If you're a small firm, then they can be too much to be worthwhile.
You talked about education. I just wanted to say, so I do absolutely believe that lifelong learning is important, and reskilling is going to be important. And I know to deliver growth, and I know that you feel very passionate about further and vocational qualifications. Having spent quite a bit of time in the Department for Education, I'd love to get your thoughts on what more needs to be done around that to help lay the foundations for sustainable growth.
Well, I mean, there's lots of things one could talk about here. I mean, I do think that we've got a... if you look at the last 15 years, the one public services which has not obviously gone backwards is actually schools, thank goodness. and so, you know, there is some positivity there. Yeah. That said, we've not made the sorts of significant changes in things like curriculum that you might expect in this new sort of world. We're still stuck with incredibly narrow curriculum at 16 to 18, where most kids are just studying three academic subjects. I think the biggest, but I think that's where the biggest challenge comes, actually, post 16, where we've got, you know, one group going through this narrow academic route on into university. That sort of works. It's not ideal, but it sort of works. And I think there's actually, by the way, quite a big job to begin to do about what it is, not how do we fund universities so much as what it is we want from universities. You know, what are we getting from the 3 years that the undergraduate spend there? To what extent is that actually providing the skills that are most valuable, and to what extent could we shift how we teach, how we regulate, how we deliver that to be more effective? I think it's a really, really tough question, by the way. Just to be clear, that's not just about is the level of funding right. It is about how we organise this, because we still, in very many ways, have a system which has developed from what was a small elite group to an education system for a small elite to one that is massified. And yes, it's absolutely true. A lot of that is much more vocational, quite rightly, than it used to be. But I think the bit of the system that's really not working in the UK, and it's very obvious, is for those who don't go on to university. We've got a very limited offer still in terms of vocational qualifications and apprenticeships, particularly at a higher level. So you compare us with most other countries. We have many fewer young people get qualified at levels between what in the international sense is called level 3 and level 6, in the UK between A-levels and degree levels. And we know also that those sort of skilled technician type roles are the ones where we're probably most in need of those skills, and that's a whole set of technical and craft skills, some old ones, sort of standard, mm-hmm. as it were, plumbers and electricians and so on, some new ones in terms of thinking about many aspects of construction, which mix the old and the new, where we're just lacking those skills, but worst of all, we're lacking the opportunities for young people to make that progress. And to be fair, it's not for want of trying to some extent by governments, but I think it's for want, again, of that word, consistency and sustainability and stability. But also, I think partly just an unwillingness to unpick some of the narrowness of the system we've had for such a long time.
And it's quite hard because it's sort of a system in itself, an educational system, takes time.
Yes, to sort of pivot. It really does.
Skills that are fit for the future are evolving, right? We know technology has become such a key part of the skills that employers are looking for, as much as some of the more traditional. So I guess, there is a question as to what's the role of business.
Absolutely.
And we ask that question of ourselves as well. We're hiring in, we've got different pathways for apprentices as much as for grads. But we do need to evolve and continue. So I just wondered if you've got any thoughts on what you're seeing or where you think businesses could really lean in on that.
Well, I think it is about how you think of your role as a business in terms of training your staff and what you do. I mean, it's just very, very tiny example. We at the IFS we employ graduates who've studied economics, but we really think of, and I think graduates should think of, the first 3 or 4 years in work as an apprenticeship anyway. I mean, it's not formally an apprenticeship, but you're not qualified to do anything when you've come out of a degree, whatever you've studied. I mean, but what you learn is through the work that you do. So I think it's unreasonable to some extent. I mean, one does hear, and I do get a little irritated by this, businesses say, well, we take on these graduates and they can't do everything. Well, no, they can't. Of course they can't. You do have a role in training. Yes, you ought to reasonably expect them to come and they can speak and write English and add up and so on. And if they've done a degree in economics, they should, know a fair bit of economics and be able to do some basic stuff. Yeah. But actually, you really do need to put a lot of time and work and effort into whether they're starting with you at 18 or whether they're starting you at 21 or whether they're starting you at 23. You, of course, you're going to have to put a lot of time and work and effort into that. And actually, that's the only way of building a sustainable organisation, a culture, and so on. And yes, of course, some of them will go. But that is part and parcel of being an effective business, it seems to me.
I absolutely agree with you. We have a responsibility, one, to the communities we work in, because that's where our colleagues come from. But equally, helping skilled people to thrive in whatever career they have, whether it's with us or elsewhere. So I do think there is a role for business to really help on this reskilling journey, because we are going to be reskilling and pivoting for the foreseeable future. Greater collaboration between business and government is a recurring theme in some of the conversations I have on this podcast. And I just wanted to get your perspective around that. We've touched on a few things here, right? Whether it's skills, whether it's, business leaning in on some of the economic choices we have to make. But I just wondered if you've got any other thoughts in terms of what more business could do in collaboration with government.
Yeah, I don't know how. I mean, one thing that you know, there's a lot of business, and despite what you might think, there's often a limited amount of government. I mean, there's really not that many people in the Treasury, and there's not that many people in the business department. And of course, the most direct relationships that business will have with government might well be with HMRC, for example.
Yep.
And that's a different
very true.
That's a different kind of engagement. But actually, it's important that HMRC is very clear and effective about what its rules are and how it interacts with business. And it's important for business to be honest and open and transparent with HMRC. I think the one of the difficulties genuinely government has, I think, is that there are a limited number, particularly of senior and experienced people, and lots of people, as I say, lots of businesses out there. And so finding the right way of funneling the right messages in is difficult. And it's difficult also, I think, for the senior civil servants to sort of know who are the people who are telling them useful stuff amongst all of this crowd of voices that will be coming towards them. And that, I think, is the real challenge. It's the working together to know what are the channels, who are the representative bodies, who are the representatives of business or business sectors or what have you that government should be listening to. And that is made more difficult by one of these things that I think irritates all of us about parts of government, which is the huge turnover of staff, ministers obviously, but also in the central parts of the civil service. People turn over so quickly very often that it's very difficult to build that knowledge base, build those relationships. And and so I think finding, as I say, some way of building stable relationships and having trust on both sides and, again, this word, sustainable relationships is important.
The reality is the topics we're discussing are evolving. We're all grappling with them. It's just that sometimes business has to grasp it faster. Sometimes government's got a better grasp on it. So we're all sort of helping each other level up in terms of our understanding. But I do absolutely think you're right. It is the quality of the relationships. And as a business, I think we've definitely seen relationships, both sides of government, definitely much more open, transparent
Good.
Dialogue
yeah.
happening
yeah.
than maybe it, I would have experienced 10, 15 years
yeah.
ago. So,
and of course, it's really incumbent on each side to understand
yeah.
the other as well.
Yeah.
I find it very often, having been in government, surprising how people outside of government, whether that's actually in academia, which I see it quite a lot, but also in business, who don't really understand or can't empathise with the real problems that governments have, the real issues that they face, the real constraints that civil servants have, or the real constraints that politicians have, and that's reflected on the other side. And I think there is some. I think we would benefit as a nation if there were actually more movement between the public and the private sectors than we have at the moment.
That's a really good point. I think we're beginning to see that, aren't we? We're beginning to see that in certain levels, but I think that's a really good point.
There's some of it, but there's not enough. And again, from my world, I'm quite close to the academic world, there's very little movement directly from one to the other.
Yeah.
And of course, in terms of moving into government, civil service pay has been cut so much over the last decade, it's quite hard for people from outside to make that transition.
Yeah, I think there's something just to recognise that, people in the civil service really want to make a difference, and that's why they're in those roles.
Absolutely. I mean, I work with great people in the civil service. Some people do get frustrated as well, because it can be quite hard to make that change depending on the constraints that they're facing.
I want to look into your crystal ball. You, as you look forward to post-election, and if you were sitting with whoever is the Chancellor at that point in time, what one, two or three bits of advice would you be giving them?
I think reflecting a lot of our conversation, I would be advising them to be thinking long-term. And I think that'd be the number one piece of advice, actually. And it sounds terribly trite, but so much of what you see in budgets is clearly not looking long term. I mean, not least, this government has been in office for 14 years and policies have gone one way and then they've been reversed and they've gone one way and then they've been reversed. They're not, you can see just very, very clearly that some of that's not being focused on the long term. And focused on the long term also in the sense of, you know, don't expect the economy to start growing next year as a result of what you do. Think about the more distant future. Then I think you'd be very clear about the importance of making sure that you're spending money on the investment side of things. So again, actually, it's very clear that one of the reasons that the National Health Service is struggling at the moment is because there just wasn't the investment in the buildings and the machinery and so on 5 or 10 years ago. In fact, money was taken out of that to, you know, keep things going at the time. You can see the urgent always kind of, you know, pushes out the important. I would say this, do think very carefully about particularly in a world where perhaps a government has a significant majority, think about, you know, the real changes to the tax system that could make a difference. And think about the problems we have with taxation of housing particularly, but also, you know, the way that corporate and self-employment and individual taxation collide and create all sorts of incentives and problems in terms of avoidance. You need to do all of those things. And, you know, again, reflecting what we were saying earlier, you know, spending on education and skills in the right way is going to pay off, but make sure it's in the right way.
So in the business context, when I'm sort of sitting with my colleagues around our board table, we are thinking 5-10 years out. Obviously, we have to look at the short to medium term as our executive deliver to that. But we always have a line of sight to the 5-10. In this context, what would you say long term would be?
I think, you know, up to 10 years.
10 years.
I think, and it's one of the, I think it's one of the difficulties with sort of the electoral cycle is that to really start to have an impact, it's going to take more than a single parliament. And if you think of, think of kind of really big ideas like levelling up, which was supposed to be Boris Johnson's big idea in 2019. Huge differences between regions of the UK. You can do something about that, but you really can't do it in one parliament, even if you had really focused on it and done all the things that you need to do, which we haven't. But if you are looking at making a significant change to the regional distribution of prosperity, you need to look at least 10 years hence. Clearly, when we're looking at things like climate change, we've got targets for 2050. So, you know, we were 25 years ahead for things like that. Now, obviously, not everything needs to be looking that long term. But, you know, for example, I was on the Climate Change Committee for a long time. And that was all about looking at what we needed to be doing, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years hence, and holding government's feet to the fire to ensure that they've got the plans to get us there. So it depends on exactly what it is you're looking at, but quite often much more long term than governments are looking at.
Yeah. And to be fair, it's probably similar in business, right? You've got to look beyond the tenure of the individual in role or the board tenure. You've got to look longer term. Just picking up on the climate committee that you were on, anything that you experienced, I mean, obviously quite a lot would have changed in the time you were there. Anything that you could share that would be helpful for people to sort of use that experience that you had, which was a 25-30 horizon, and really sort of breaking it down into deliverable chunks. Is there anything that you'd be happy to share?
I think part of it is not to try. I think if the Climate Change Committee made mistakes, it was almost in trying to be too precise about, you know, exactly what you need to be doing, rather than setting the frameworks of it. But I think what was really valuable was just being clear. You know, there is a law which the government has made, which is we get to net zero by 2050. If you're going to get there, then there are a set of things you need to have achieved on the way, and particularly if you're going to do it in the most cost-efficient fashion. And that means, you know, again, long. It really does mean long-term planning. It also means focusing on the delivery as well as the strategy. And governments have come out with lots of strategies and not delivered.
It's delivery,
but they've also failed on some of the strategy parts of it as well. You just need a relentless focus on that kind of thing. And I think one of the again, one of the problems in climate change, but also right across government, is that things can, again, the urgent pushes out the important, that things which you say you're focusing on, you know, just drift off the priority list. And you see it. I mean, you see it time and time again, even within departments. Something that's flavour of the moment stops being flavour of the moment. You need that consistency of drive and delivery. But on the positive side with climate change, I'd say actually it's among the few things where there is, you know, there is considerable, I think, focus on the long term and a reasonable amount of political consensus, and you know, definitely needs more drive and delivery than it's had. But relative to most things, I think it's probably better managed than many.
But there's something to learn from that. You've just articulated it. You need to have flexibility and agility in how you address something, but you've got to have relentless focus on the delivery, but you have a really clear ambition. So there is something to learn from that on all those 4 points you've just shared as well. So that's really helpful. So you've been the longest serving director at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and we know each other because I'm on the advisory council there, but you also started at the Institute of Fiscal Studies. So you've come back having done a pretty long senior stint in government. What brought you back, or what is it that you brought back from your experience in government that's really helped you be so successful in the role that you're in today?
Well, I think what brought me back is it's just a great place to, you know, it's a fantastic, fantastic organisation, and does really important work. Brilliant set, absolutely brilliant set of colleagues, lovely culture. I mean, all of those things that you want from an organisation. Although what it doesn't have is the what government has a definite has a definite revenue stream. We don't, which can keep me awake at night. What did I learn in government? Well, partly just a lot about how government works. Yeah. Obviously, in a way we were talking about earlier, that what the pressures are on the Treasury, what the pressures are on ministers, on spending departments,
yeah.
As well as very broad. I mean, I worked on a whole broad set of things in government: transport, climate change, pay, all aspects of education, financial sector, and so on. So, you do get a pretty good broad overview of quite a lot of things in government. And then the other thing about what brought you back: you have a degree of freedom outside of government that you just don't in the civil service. You are quite constrained, and it is very nice to have that freedom.
We do see a lot of you on TV, Paul.
Sorry.
And I'm sure we're going to see a lot more of you as the year passes by. very welcome. I'm going to just ask you a question, only because you are a visiting professor at UCL, so you see these bright minds of the future coming through, and having just talked about what the experience you've had in government, outside of government, as you look forward, what sort of qualities do you think the leaders of the future are going to need?
Oh, gosh. What sort of qualities are the leaders of the future going to need? Again, this is going to sound probably terribly trite, but I mean, the things that I really value and need, clearly a sort of understanding of the technology that we're working with, that they're working with, and I mean they already have far better sense of that than I do. And it's amazing. I mean, some of my colleagues, my senior colleagues, are taking on junior colleagues and saying that they can now do in a couple of weeks what it took them 6 months to do, because the way that AI helps you to write big statistical programs and so on. So we are the progress we're making is astonishing in that area. I mean, communication and capacity in my world, I've got lots of, I mean, there are lots and lots of much, much better economists in academia and so on than I am. But actually, the capacity to explain what they're doing and why it's important and what its role is, I think, is often lacking. So that sort of capacity to understand what's important and how to communicate it just seems to be so, so desperately important. The other thing that I think is just so important is that that empathy with your colleagues and ability to get the right culture going for an organisation or whoever you're working with. and you know, just actually really, really thinking what you're doing is important as well, I think. Yeah. I think if you don't think what you're doing is important, if you're not enjoying what you're doing, then, you know, you probably don't make you're probably not going to be enjoying your work much, but you're certainly not going to be making a great working environment for your colleagues.
I feel like I can hold a mirror up to you, Paul, there, because, you know, recognising what's important. But I love the capacity to understand what's important, which is quite difficult to see the wood for the trees sometimes.
Yeah.
And then the trickiest thing is to articulate it and communicate it in a very succinct, simple way. Mm. If nothing else, if our audience could take that away, if I could take that away, that would be a very, very positive outcome of this conversation. I was going to turn to you, if that's okay, Paul. If you could go back to the younger Paul Johnson, is there anything that you wish you'd known at the beginning of your career?
I mean, a whole load of things. I suppose, you know, to some extent, I've always, I wish I could have been more confident in a way about, what my career might hold, and maybe occasionally have been a bit braver, because I guess I was brought up to think you should be thankful you've got a job rather than you should really be aiming for great things. And I think that can make one a little bit conservative at times. And I suppose one of the things that I'm probably glad I didn't know it at the time, because I think it's important to learn it, that actually I've learnt more about the kind of, you know, culture and organisation and so on that I thrive in. And I that's probably why I've ended up back at the IFS, because that is the kind of culture and environment that I thrive in.
I mean, it's easy with hindsight, isn't it? Mm. But you're right, you know, when you would have been 18 or 20, you know, if you'd had a little bit of gold dust, what would that gold dust have been? Mm. Confidence, maybe, in your case.
Well, I think it probably would.
I suspect
would,
it's probably in my case too, to be fair. To be fair, it would have been me too. What's the best bit of advice you've ever been given?
I think when you're thinking about, you know, a job or something, you should always be thinking about, you know, not is it sort of good enough, or is it, less good or more good than the other one, but is it actually the right fit?
You're very busy, as I said. You know, I've heard you early on the radio early in the morning. You're on the news. You run the IFS. You've got a lot of research that you put out. What sustains you outside of work?
Well, I mean, I've got now grown up kids. I'm not sure if they sustain me or just make life harder, but. the family, kids have always been a very important part of everything. In terms of what I do, I manage to try and get enough exercise to keep me sane, including swimming in cold water through the winter.
Really?
Yeah. A bit mad, but it does give you quite a rush, and. Yeah, I mean, it's when going on holiday, really getting away.
Can you really switch off though when you're away? Given that you're thinking about things all the time.
It's one of the things. Actually, I'm sure people listening to this work. The IFS isn't a particularly huge organisation. What have we got? 8 or 9 million pound turnover, but it is, you know. And you say I'm busy because I'm on the radio or whatever. Actually, what I'm busy with is running a. You know, essentially a small bit. It's a charity, but it's essentially running a small business with a, you know, £9 million turnover and 80 staff, and you know that is on your mind all the time, particularly when it's also in the public domain, and you need to get that bit right. So there's no question that switching off is hard. It really is hard. So do I ever fully switch off? I'm not sure that I ever do.
Well, the work of the IFS is never done, and it's such an important part of our system, educational system, in the sense that your research is really, really valued by corporates and by the public. What you say matters. Everybody listens to what you say because they know it's independent, it's impartial, it's credible, it's quite a big responsibility to carry around, and the fact that you've been doing it for so many years already really tells us, you know, how seriously you take your job. So thank you for doing what you do.
Well, thank you.
We will value it.
If anyone listening to this really values it, they can join us as an individual or corporate member, which you know, we are almost entirely dependent actually on winning research from charitable foundations and research councils, but we do have a small amount of donations, which are always very gratefully received.
So thank you very much, Paul, for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you, to hear your perspectives, because they are so broad. But the one big takeaway, the four bits of advice for whoever is Chancellor in however many months' time that may be. Number one, focus long term, and that is where we're talking about 10 years at least. So let's have a really good plan of how we're going to deliver long term sustainable growth. And as you said, it's shared growth that benefits all. Number two was spending on investment. So, i.e., let's invest where we need to invest to deliver that growth, and let's make those hard choices. But can't always expect to see those returns in the short term. So let's hold our nerve to see those returns. Number three, you talked about it early on about having a very sensible, well-managed tax system. So I take from that there's quite a bit that you would change in there that you've just talked about. And number four, which I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with, is spending on education, helping our younger population be equipped for the work of the future, to help businesses grow, to help the economy grow. So I think those are the big four bits of advice. And I absolutely think your advice on individuals having the capacity to understand what's important, see through, and actually be able to communicate it is a really nice personal thing, as much as make sure you've got confidence in what you can do. So thank you very much for joining me today.
It's been fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me today on Pull Up a Chair, whether you're at home, at work, or somewhere in between. I do hope you'll join me next time for more insights from business leaders and thinkers on how to unlock sustainable growth that delivers to the needs of people, planet, and profit. Goodbye.